What's up with WhatsApp today on the world? I'm Marco Werman. The messaging app is everywhere across the globe, an all-purpose alternative to phone service.
I use it for work and I use it to communicate with my family and my boyfriend as well. So I use WhatsApp to communicate to people all the time, basically.
But it turns out WhatsApp's vaunted security is not fail-safe after all. We'll take a look at the technology behind the hack of WhatsApp and why human rights defenders are worried. And in Russia, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Putin's government needs to act in good faith when it comes to U.S. elections.
There are things that Russia can do to demonstrate that these types of activities are a thing of the past.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you have WhatsApp on your phone, do yourself a favor and make sure you're running the latest version. WhatsApp has issued a patch to fix a serious security flaw, and it's urging all of the app's 1.5 billion users to update. Yep, that's billion with a B. In many countries around the globe, WhatsApp is the way to communicate, more important than wireless phone service, texting, or email. Listen to this teacher in Brazil.
WhatsApp is really important to me. I cannot think how I would talk to so many people at the same time if I didn't have it. I mean, other social medias, they are not as fast and as easy as WhatsApp.
In a bit, we'll hear more about how reliant Isabel Santos in Rio is on WhatsApp. The company, which is owned by Facebook, says it discovered a targeted attack on some of its users. It involved a piece of spyware that can be installed via a simple WhatsApp call, even if the user doesn't pick up. The software reportedly used in the attack was developed by an Israeli company that says it only sells to governments. That worries Donna Ingleton of Amnesty International.
Governments are buying these tools to fight crime and terrorism, but we also know some governments with atrocious human rights records are buying this tool and using it to target human rights defenders.
John Scott Railton is a senior researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. He and a colleague there tracked an attempted attack on a user a couple of days ago. John, what happened here? How did cyber attackers manage to hack WhatsApp and inject the spyware onto iPhones and Android devices?
So what we were looking at here was a case that, if we believe what WhatsApp says, where an attacker had been using this very sophisticated technique that could basically infect any phone that had a WhatsApp account on it without any interaction from the user, and then use that digital door to place a piece of spyware on that phone, and then that phone could be monitored and private communications stolen.
How does this spyware actually work? What's it called?
We're actually not talking about a spyware here. We're talking about a vulnerability, which doesn't have a name beyond the sort of industry designation of a CVE. And it's a vulnerability in the way that WhatsApp connected phone calls. And it allowed an attacker to basically give just a missed call to some WhatsApp user. And then during the process of that missed call, place a piece of malware on that user's device.
So the vulnerability is on the devices, correct?
The vulnerability is with WhatsApp itself and the way that WhatsApp handles phone calls. WhatsApp, of course, made this public and began filtering attacks using this vulnerability as of Friday and then pushed out an update to all of its users on Monday.
The specific kind of thing, though, that got put onto a lot of WhatsApp accounts was a spyware called Pegasus, correct?
Well, right now, no one is saying publicly exactly what was done with this vulnerability. What WhatsApp is saying is that they saw users being targeted with this actively. What we're saying from the Citizen Lab is that we observed a case on Sunday of a user targeted using this same vulnerability.
Tell us more about what you observed on Sunday. You tracked this attempted attack. Do you know where it was coming from and who it was targeting?
So on Sunday, we had been tracking the case of a London-based lawyer who has represented victims of Pegasus spyware in Mexico and from Saudi Arabia. Pegasus spyware is made by an Israeli spyware company called NSO Group, which has been in the news for several years because its technology, which is very powerful, has been linked to a lot of abuses, many of them found by myself and my colleague. On Sunday, this lawyer received 2 missed calls, and we believed that those missed calls were attempts from an unknown number to hack his phone and insinuate a piece of spyware onto the phone. Now, fascinatingly, that attack failed. And we realized that it failed because on Friday, just 2 days before, WhatsApp had begun blocking attempts to use this vulnerability across its network. So this also means that we can say we're pretty confident that WhatsApp has figured out how to fix the problem. And what users should take away from this, I think, is not a concern about WhatsApp, because I think WhatsApp was very responsive and comes out looking aggressively in favor of keeping its users safe. I think they should be concerned about the companies that are selling this kind of spyware and this kind of exploit technology, and concerned about the fact that this makes us all less secure.
So NSO Group, they produce Pegasus, they make the software. Who are they? Because they've been described as secretive. And do we know what the response is to the news of this WhatsApp breach?
They've made some statements publicly saying that they wouldn't nor could they have done this attack, and that they investigate all abuses, to which, you know, an informed reader might ask, well, but have any of your customers perhaps been responsible for this case? To which there does not appear to be an answer yet from NSO. I think the big issue is that they're part of an industry that claims that it can police itself, or at least can sell to customers who police themselves. And neither of those things seems to be very true.
Yeah. So what about you, John? Do you use WhatsApp?
You know, I do use WhatsApp. My sense is that it's important for everyone to move as much as possible towards using good, strong, encrypted communications. And we shouldn't view this case as discouraging us from that. Instead, I think part of the lesson that we should take away is that being secure on our devices is really important, and that we should all be concerned that there are companies out there selling the technology and causing the proliferation of the technology to attack our devices. It's pretty unprecedented for a company like WhatsApp to be proactive in getting in touch with human rights organizations. And I think it suggests something more generally, which is the industry and big platforms are pretty fed up with this kind of abuse and with the companies that sell these technologies. Right now, those companies are in the process of trying to tell the world that they're turning a new leaf. NSO was acquired at the beginning of this year by a UK-based firm. With that new ownership, NSO made a big PR push, probably spent a lot of money to try to tell the world, look, we've got adults in the room now, we're under new management, we're setting up a lot of provisions so that these abuses won't happen. We won't confirm the ones that happened in the past, but we can tell you that going forward, we're good. And I think that this case demonstrates, if indeed this was NSO, that they have a long way to go.
As best as you can tell, why would hackers do this? Is it to track people, like who they're in touch with and know their contacts, or is it just kind of sow chaos and see what sticks?
Well, in this case, I think we're looking at a very expensive technology. So if we're talking about NSO, we're looking at something that costs governments millions. And in theory, it's supposed to be used in pretty surgical ways. Unfortunately, in the past several years, we've been investigating cases in Mexico where it's used in the most reckless way possible. We see people from, you know, sort of a childhood anti-obesity advocate to the minor child of a Mexican journalist in boarding school in the U.S. targeted with this stuff.
Wow.
In some sense, this is an industry that would like you to believe that, you know, they're kind of coming in Mission Impossible style and giving you the techniques to track bad actors. But what we're seeing is that in some cases, the bad behavior is coming from the governments that have bought this technology, and they're not using it in a very sophisticated way. In fact, they're using it in a way that's so unsophisticated that they get caught, as they did on Sunday.
Have you ever been able to track any Pegasus or any spyware back to a specific government?
Indeed, our work, as well as the investigations of our partners at Amnesty International, as well as a bunch of NGOs around the world, has linked a number of governments, including the Mexican government, the Saudi government, the UAE government, to specific cases of abuse. And there are a number of ongoing legal cases around that. The lawyer who was targeted is actually a lawyer representing victims in one of those cases.
That's the lawyer in London that the attempted attack you were tracking on Sunday.
That's correct.
John Scott Railton is a senior researcher at the Citizen Lab, a think tank based at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. John, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Margot.
We mentioned earlier that WhatsApp has 1.5 billion users worldwide and how in some countries the app is everywhere. Case in point, Brazil, clocking in with 120 million active users, including 24-year-old teacher Isabel Santos in Rio de Janeiro.
I use WhatsApp all the time. I use it in the morning because I teach in the morning, so I have to communicate with my students. I use in the afternoon, and I use at night because I teach during the whole day. I also talk to people abroad. So my boyfriend is not Brazilian. He's English. So I speak to his family, which is in England. I wouldn't be surprised to hear that all Brazilians use WhatsApp all the time because the telephone companies, they are not very good in here. So once we can use one social media to do everything, to message, to call, and to make video calls, everything just is just easier. Now, actually saying all that, I realize how much I use WhatsApp.
That's Isabel Santos, one of the 120 million WhatsApp users in Rio de Janeiro. We've got an election in the Philippines that we've got to talk about. Millions of people turned out to vote in the midterms yesterday there. The vote was seen by many as a referendum on the country's controversial president, Rodrigo Duterte. My BBC colleague Howard Johnson in Manila has been tracking the results as they come in.
This midterm election is widely considered here as a referendum on Duterte, as you say. 3 years ago, he was elected to power on a ticket of hardline policies, a drug war in which we've seen thousands of people killed. Human rights groups say, you know, many of them killed extrajudicially. Now, you know, a lot of people outside of the country have condemned President Duterte for his strategy. But in this country, President Duterte is incredibly popular, 79% approval rating in April. And lots of people wanted to know whether that would translate to a win in these crucial senatorial elections. Now, what we've seen is President Duterte's allies do incredibly well. They've really gained massive control of the Senate. There were 12 seats up for grabs. The opposition didn't get a single one of those seats. And it looks like now that the Senate is full of Duterte's allies. And that means he now has control of the legislation agenda and can push things through without any opposition.
Yeah, push things through like what? Like how could things change at this point?
Well, his candidates have been talking about reintroducing the death penalty for drug traffickers. Lots of people are saying, well, why do you need that when you already are killing people in the streets without due process? That's what human rights groups say. But also there's discussion about lowering the criminal age of liability for children. Initially, that was mooted at 9 years old, but there was a lot of kickback from opposition senators saying, you know, that's a bit too young for our liking. It was eventually settled at 12. It wasn't voted on, but now that the opposition have been decimated in the Senate, you know, it could be up for grabs again that the age is reduced to 9 years old.
I mean, it's kind of baffling for people who don't live in the Philippines. And you've got these human rights organizations all over the globe with serious concerns about President Duterte. When you speak with his supporters, why do they back him? Why is there this incredibly high popularity rating for Duterte in the Philippines?
Yeah, I visited his power base, Davao, the city where he was mayor for more than two decades, just last week to get a better understanding of President Duterte. I've spoken to lots of people in Manila as well, and the same sort of statements ring time and again. What it is that they say is the streets feel safer. There is a meth problem in this country, meth epidemic. People here said that meth users were causing trouble in their neighborhoods. They felt that nothing was being done about it. They said that the Liberal government that were in here before weren't doing enough, and that they really liked the idea that President Duterte was going to take action one way or another. Let's not forget, he was democratically elected after he said he would kill people. So people here voted for that, and as we've seen again, they have voted to increase his power in this country. People here really don't seem to have an issue with this idea of human rights. That's a sort of almost an alien concept to many people outside of the liberal elite of Manila. Outside in the provinces, it's a very esoteric, strange concept that doesn't really apply to them. They'd rather see rough justice and the meth addicts, you know, wiped off the streets.
That's my BBC colleague Howard Johnson speaking with us from Manila. Howard, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, we meet a man who makes a living selling fallout shelters. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's been just over a year since President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen.
What would have happened? Did the president's decision make us safer today than we would have otherwise been? That is the guiding question for the new season of the PRX podcast, Things That Go Boom, with Lacey Healy. And Lacey, you know a thing or two about nuclear policy.
I know a thing or two. I've been working in nuclear policy for a long time. But I, you know, this is a new world that we're living in. And this is a situation where, you know, we no longer can make deals that are lasting deals. Obama, actually, the really important point about the Iran nuclear deal is that it's not a treaty, which means that President Trump could come in and he could break it immediately as soon as he walked through the door. And so, you know, what kind of world are we living in where we can't even sign treaties with other countries that keep us out of nuclear war? Things have changed very fundamentally. And I think that's really one of the central questions that we're asking here on Things That Go Boom this season is how much have they changed and how much danger has that put us in?
Yeah, there are a whole range of people involved in this nuclear world that we're going to hear from, not just on Things That Go Boom, but we'll also hear them on the world in the coming weeks. So who can we expect to hear from?
Really everyone involved with the making of the Iran nuclear deal, or nearly everyone. We spoke to the folks in the Obama administration, like Jake Sullivan and Wendy Sherman, who negotiated this thing. We talked to folks in the Trump administration, like Brian Hook with the State Department, who was involved in, you know, not only trying to negotiate a follow-on agreement, but also involved in the ultimate decision to pull out of the deal. And then for a little bit of fun, we also talked to my mom.
Well, we'll hear from your mom in a moment, but we begin today with someone who actually cashed in on something I was really surprised to find out about. There's actually been a spike in sales of fallout shelters. I didn't even know they're still a thing.
Yeah, they are still a thing, and actually even more of a thing with all this talk of fire and fury lately. So this guy that we talked to, he's really fantastic. I'm going to let him go ahead and introduce himself because he can do it better than I can for sure.
My name's Ron Hubbard. I'm the owner and president of Atlas Survival Shelters.
Shelters might sound like a relic of the past, so we were a little surprised to find out that actually the fallout shelter business is booming. Just ask Ron.
And there's a famous Ron Hubbard. Do you get that a lot?
No, I'm no relation, but yeah, I get that every day.
So yeah, we're not here to talk to Ron about Scientology. We're also not here to talk to him about his political beliefs, though a few might creep in. We reached out to Ron because he's one of the most prominent manufacturers of fallout shelters today.
How'd I get in the bomb shelters? Well, my career as a supermodel wasn't going so well.
Ron's tall, tan, has sort of a guy next door vibe. So it's all the more surprising when he talks about his line of work. He got his start about 8 years ago.
The shelter that we make today is basically just a derivative and a copy of the shelter that was designed back in the early 60s and late 50s.
Ron says he sold a shelter a month when he started out in 2011, then one a week. Now, he sells about one a day. In addition to shelters, Ron's something of a survival gear aficionado. He has his own YouTube channel where he hands down tips on hoarding for doomsday.
Hey, everybody! My name's Billy Bombproof, and I'm here to tell you about the new Billy Bombproof channel.
I am literally doing this podcast from my my cash room, which is where I cache all my survival supplies.
Guns, axes, backpacks, tents.
Survival food, water purification system, stoves, ovens, knives, bows and arrows, slingshots.
Product and get a laugh or two. So tune in to.
But it's not just doomsday preppers like Ron buying these things. A lot of his clients are in Japan, Saudi Arabia, places where the threat of a nuclear attack still feels as visceral as it did to the U.S. in the 60s. Because, at least in those cases, it's right next door. In the U.S. today, the threat of nuclear weapons can get lost in what seems like a constant barrage of threats, big and small. That is, until there's an incident.
This just into CNN. It's the moment many people in Hawaii found out about the inbound missile that turned out to be a false alarm.
Moments ago, an erroneous, a false alert went out by a text message in social media, which warned the people of Hawaii to...
Yes, after the Hawaiian scare, the amount of business in Hawaii went through the roof. So I got maybe 200 emails within the 5 days from Hawaii that people were really scared, and they should be scared.
Hi, Mom.
Hi.
My parents live in Hawaii, so they were there during the scare, which, if you remember, came right on the heels of months of fire and fury-filled tension between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, some people put their children down in sewer drains.
Given how real the threat of a nuclear attack was at the time,
My parents' reaction threw me off completely. So I sat down with my mom to ask her about one thing in particular that stuck with me.
Well, you didn't call me, for one thing.
Nor your sister.
Which I'm a little offended.
So I thought about both of you, both my daughters, about calling. But I thought you only have 15 minutes. So which is your favorite? So I didn't call anybody.
You can turn it into a party room. You can turn it into your hobby and craft
room. One of Ron's most popular designs doubles as a wine cellar.
Where the stairs are actually hidden underneath the kitchen counter.
But some of his custom builds feel more like lavish retreats. He built one with a swimming pool and a bowling alley. And after California's deadly wildfire season last year, he started offering a fire shelter. He also builds a model for just $9,000. Ron says it's not much more than a prison cell with a toilet and a bed, but it's something. He says he wants to be the Henry Ford of fallout shelters, make them accessible for all.
It may not be a luxury yacht, okay? It may be a canoe, you know, but a canoe and a yacht, what they have in common, they both float and they both keep you from drowning.
Ron told us he doesn't like to get his nose in other people's business, so he doesn't ask why people are buying these things. But he's pretty sure something is coming to a head. He calls it the inevitable end of the world as we know it. And in his view, it's all tied up with how divided our country's become.
People might be listening, oh, that's freaking crazy. There will never be a war. Well, tell that to the people of Germany during World War II. The whole country was devastated. You never know what's going to start a war, but this country is so divided.
Apparently, sales took a dip last year after tensions settled and Trump met with Kim Jong-un. Ron says people felt safer.
There's no country in the world in the right mind would mess with Trump right now because they know that he would bomb them. Nobody wants to mess with that man because they know they're going to lose. Obama got pushed around like a punk kid.
But Trump's own intelligence folks say North Korea is unlikely to give up its nuclear stockpile. And to make matters worse, some nuclear experts say that today, the threat of a global meltdown is the worst it's been since the darkest, most dangerous days of the Cold War.
Lacey Healy is the host of Things That Go Boom. It's a podcast from PRX, and you can find a link to it at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Many young people in Northern Ireland were not alive during the decades of violence there, and some feel like they missed out.
They wanted the madness, the riots, the shootings, the bombings. You know, they were all spent their time kind of reminiscing, or quote-unquote, excitedly about this.
Nostalgia for the Troubles. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It was sunny and warm in the Russian resort city of Sochi today. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled there to meet with his Russian counterpart and with President Vladimir Putin. Unlike the city where they met, the U.S.-Russian relationship is probably better described as overcast and chilly. In any case, Pompeo was looking on the bright side. He told reporters, "I am here today because President Trump is committed to improving this relationship." But as The World's Matthew Bell reports, actually resetting U.S.-Russia ties is a long shot.
When Putin wants to host foreign guests in a relaxed atmosphere, he meets them in Sochi, where Russia hosted the 2014 Winter Olympics.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin.
Putin spends a good amount of time in this city that was rebuilt in part to glorify his presidency. It's the perfect setting for Putin's first meeting with a high-level American official in nearly a year.
It is important that Mike Pompeo is visiting. He was, as a director of the CIA, one of the first officials from Trump administration to actually pay a visit to Russia. And then he hosted Russian intelligence and security chiefs in Washington.
Simon Sarajan is director of the Russia Matters Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He says Pompeo has an established relationship with the Russians, and the timing for this meeting is good, too.
With the Mueller report already published, this dark cloud has not dissipated, but has perhaps changed color.
And Sarajan says there are areas where the U.S. and Russia want to work together. Counterterrorism is one. Both governments want to lower the threat posed by international terrorist groups like ISIS. Arms control is another one. Neither country wants nuclear war, and Sarajan says extending the New START treaty aimed at preventing an arms race between the U.S. and Russia is something that's achievable.
But when it comes to other arms control agreements, such as the INF treaty, which specifically bans both sides from deploying medium-range nuclear delivery systems, I expect that treaty to die regardless of Pompeo's visit.
After meeting Russian officials today, the Secretary of State said arms control was discussed, along with many other issues, including ones where the two sides disagree. Pompeo said he spoke with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov about Russian interference in U.S. elections.
We spoke, too, about the question of interference in our domestic affairs. I convened that there are things that Russia can do to demonstrate that these types of activities are a thing of the past, and I hope that Russia will take advantage of those opportunities.
Later, President Putin told Pompeo that Russia has never interfered in U.S. elections. Pompeo said that President Trump has made it clear he wants to see an improved relationship between the U.S. and Russia, that this will benefit the people of both countries. Pompeo said that his meetings in Sochi are a good step in that direction. On that point, the Russian foreign minister said he agrees.
Но в целом могу сказать, что разговор получился.
Sergei Lavrov said today's talks with Pompeo were frank and useful. Relations with the U.S. are not going through their best times, he said, but there is much potential for cooperation. Simon Sarajan says that's true, but there are still some big areas where the two sides do not agree at all. One of them is Iran.
Russia continues to see value in the agreement that U.S., among other countries, have signed with Iran, and would like that agreement to remain in place. The U.S. has a different view on how to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions. And unfortunately, this is an issue where they will probably agree to disagree. And I expect that to remain an irritant in the bilateral relationship.
Another place where the U.S. and Russia have divergent views is in Venezuela. Moscow supports the government of Nicolas Maduro. Washington backs the opposition leader Juan Guaido. There's been discussion in the Russian media about a possible trade-off. Russia would back off in Venezuela if the Trump administration agreed to ease up on sanctions imposed on Russia. Those sanctions came into effect after Russia occupied parts of Ukraine. Essentially, the two sides would agree to stay out of each other's sphere of influence. Sarajan doubts that arrangement will work.
So Donald Trump cannot lift all the sanctions on Russia, even if he wanted to pursue a trade-off over Venezuela. So Congress has a role, and I very much doubt, given the past history of congressional sanctioning of Russia, that Congress will move quickly to lift sanctions on Russia.
He says there is a chance for the Trump administration to take a step toward normalizing the relationship with the Kremlin. But some of these fundamental disagreements on Iran, Syria, and Ukraine, for example, are going to play out for years to come. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
For decades, Hanan Ashrawi has been a high-profile figure in Palestinian politics. As an executive committee member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, she negotiated with secretaries of state and met with American presidents from both parties. Yesterday, for the first time, the State Department denied Ashrawi's application for a U.S. visa. She says U.S. officials did not offer a reason for rejecting her request.
After they asked for all sorts of details and minute questions about, you know, the last 15 years of my life and where I've been and so on. Then they asked for a new itinerary, and when we tried to get it to them, they said, never mind, the visa application has been rejected.
You've applied, presumably, for a U.S. visa before, right?
Yes, I studied in the U.S. I travel there every year. I join negotiations in Washington. This is the first time this has happened anywhere. I mean, but this kind of rejection is bizarre because it comes in the context, actually, of a very vicious attack against the Palestinian leadership by the Trump administration. And, of course, a total assault on all the core issues that are the basis of any negotiations. So compared to what they've done to Jerusalem and the refugees and the two-state solution, denying me a visa is nothing other than being symptomatic of a very petty approach to politics.
Well, despite that aggressive approach to the Palestinian people, the Trump administration's Middle East envoy, Jason Greenblatt, wrote on Twitter in February to say that you, Hanan Ashrawi, had an open invitation to D.C. So have you reached out to him?
Yeah, he said that I have an open invitation, but without a visa, it would be very difficult to get to the White House. They've really smashed the negotiating table to smithereens.
How will this inability to travel to the U.S. impact you, both politically and personally?
Well, politically, of course, I won't be able to attend many meetings and because I am on board of several institutions in the U.S. Of course, we also meet with Congress and so on. This is one way of having dialogue that is candid, that is honest, that is direct. But at the same time, something that really hurts me is the fact that I have grandchildren in the States. I have my daughter and her husband and family. I have my sister. I have nephews and nieces. I mean, look, my daughters lost their IDs because Israel decided to cancel their Jerusalem IDs. So they had to live outside. Now in the States, they're not allowing me to go to the States to see them, to see my daughter. So I guess we'll have to look for a third place to see each other. This separation of families has been symptomatic of the occupation all along. And now the U.S. is part of that as well.
Hanan Ashrawi continues to be a high-profile figure in Palestinian politics. This week, her application for a U.S. visa was denied. Ms. Ashrawi, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
You're most welcome, Mark.
We asked the State Department for comment. A spokesperson responded to say visa records are confidential under U.S. law, but noted that visas are never denied based solely on political statements or views. More than 20 years ago, President Clinton went to Derry, Northern Ireland, to deliver a message of hope. The Troubles were almost over, and Catholics and Protestants were on the brink of peace.
Standing here in front of the Guildhall, looking out over these historic walls, I see a peaceful city, a safe city.
That moment seems like a million years ago. Today, the future of Northern Ireland is uncertain. The power-sharing government there collapsed 2 years ago. Brexit threatens to reestablish a hard border with the Republic of Ireland. And violence is again a major concern, especially after the fatal shooting last month of 29-year-old journalist Lyra McKee in Derry. In the midst of all of this, some young people are looking back the bad old days of the Troubles with longing. Filmmaker Sinead O'Shea explores this and other themes in a documentary called A Mother Brings Her Son to Be Shot. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with O'Shea about the film and one of the people in it.
Sinead, tell me about how you met Kevin Barry.
So Kevin Barry was the youngest in a family who'd been very badly affected by the violence which has continued in Northern Ireland since the apparent ending of the Troubles. And I'd spent 5 years with this family, and towards the end of this time, Kevin Barry had told me that he would like the Troubles to return. And it was a really shocking statement, obviously, because actually Kevin Barry doesn't remember the Troubles. He was born after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, which brought this apparent peace to Northern Ireland.
Do other people share his nostalgia, or it's not even nostalgia because he didn't even live through it, his sense that, oh, it would be great
to
have the
Troubles
again?
Yeah, it's an imagined nostalgia. It's really interesting. And yeah, I mean, in the film, you know, he told me that it was he and his friends who had these feelings. And he said all of his friends felt the same way. You know, they wanted the madness, the riots, the shootings, the bombings. You know, they were all spent their time kind of reminiscing, quote unquote, excitedly about this.
I want you to put your psychoanalyst hat on for a minute, or your sociologist cap. What is really going on here? I mean, what's this about?
I think what he's thinking is that the Troubles were a time of status and purpose for the community and for people like him. So now as a 16-year-old within that community, his prospects aren't great. You know, unemployment levels are amongst the highest there in Western Europe. I think also that some of them have grown up around people who are suffering from what I could see was a kind of undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, a lot of people there, they're very addicted to conflict and they find it quite difficult to live in peace. And so I saw while I was there over those 5 years that people were continually recreating conflict when there wasn't really any need for things to be like that.
Can you give an example?
I mean, anything. I drove around one day with, at the time, new IRA members. They're a distant Republican paramilitary grouping, I guess. And I saw how people were approaching them, you know, with complaints about hand mirrors, you know, or wing mirrors on a car. And as far as some of these local people were concerned, this was something that they were going to take to the new IRA to sort out for them.
But what is the issue? So what's the issue with a hand mirror?
Someone had broken their wing mirror in this incident. But I'm just saying that's a really trivial affair. That's not something I think anyone should approach a paramilitary grouping about. But I just think people have become so used to escalating any issue that it becomes really dangerous. And I think an area can become quite explosive as a result of that deeply ingrained habit.
What prompted you to make a documentary about Northern Ireland post-Troubles?
I'd heard the case of a woman called Magella who had made the decision to bring her eldest son, Philly, to be shot in the legs as a punishment shooting. He had come to the attention of paramilitary, of local gunmen, who said that he was selling drugs and that he didn't want drug dealers in the community. So he was warned to stop. The thing escalated. Eventually, his mother was told she had to either bring him to be shot or they were going to break into the house and drag him onto the front garden and shoot him there. And he'd be left in a far worse state. He could be crippled, put in a wheelchair. So, you know, it was a really extreme incident, but having said that, what I discovered when I went there was that there were lots of these incidents taking place. This is a community who don't believe in the police, they don't believe in the courts, they don't believe in the UK government. So they have their own justice, quote unquote, system. And, you know, you get quite extreme results when people are left to self-police.
In the case of this mother and her son, why do they go along with it?
Why would the mother decide to bring her son to be shot?
Yes.
She felt she had no choice. I mean, I was exactly the same. I was like, well, why wouldn't you go to the police? Why wouldn't you make an exception and go to the police? But they really resolutely do not believe in the police. They believe the police are there to attack them, not to protect them. And so there was never an option to go to the police. I asked her afterwards, did she regret not going to the police? And she said, no, she didn't, no regrets. And it never really crossed her mind. I've asked them too about moving out. I mean, I think I would move out if I was put under that kind of threat. But again, that's not an option. They're very committed and very loyal to their neighborhoods.
Are you concerned that there's going to be more violence in Derry because of this nostalgia for the Troubles and this strange vigilante kind of self-justice going on?
Yeah, I am concerned. There have been, I think since the start of February, there have been 4 shooting by appointments. Then a bomb was exploded outside the local courthouse in Derry. Nobody was injured, but I mean, it was really quite a miracle that nobody was injured. And despite all the condemnation and outrage that followed the shooting of Lyra McKee, a self-declared distant Republican candidate topped the poll in the local elections that took place a few weeks ago there.
Sinead O'Shea is the writer and director of the documentary A Mother Brings Her Son to be Shot. The film is about life in Northern Ireland since the Troubles. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for your time.
The World's Carol Hill speaking there with Sinead O'Shea. Her documentary is A Mother Brings Her Son to be Shot, about life in Northern Ireland since the Troubles. The move is being called unprecedented. Yesterday, a group of indigenous people from the Torres Strait Islands, nestled between Australia and Papua New Guinea, filed a complaint with the United Nations. They're accusing Australia of breaching their human rights by not doing enough to tackle climate change. Sophie Marjanak is with Client Earth, a nonprofit backing the complaint. She's also the lead lawyer on the case. Who were the Torres Strait Islanders behind this complaint? What exactly are they alleging?
So our clients come from 4 of the most low-lying islands in the Torres Strait. And they are among some of the most vulnerable people and communities in the world to the impacts of climate change, and in particular sea level rise. And they are alleging that Australia, through its failure to help them to adapt to climate change by building infrastructure and other defense, coastal defenses, but also by failing to mitigate the cause of greenhouse emissions, that Australia is breaching its human rights obligations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the key breaches alleged are of the right to culture. So that's the right of minority peoples to enjoy their culture, the right to a family and home life, and also the right to life.
So we've got the thoughts of one Torres Strait Islander. His name is Kabe Tamu, and he described their dilemma this way.
If we are asked to move away, I feel that it will be colonization all over again, because being colonized, you get taken off your land, you stop using your language, you stop practicing your culture, and that's what's going to happen if we eventually are moved and become environmental or climate change refugee.
So, Sophie Marjanak, what exactly are the people of the Torres Strait Islands saying is happening to their homeland that would force them to leave? Like, how do those people describe the pressure they're facing?
They are living with the impacts of climate change every day. The most obvious thing for them is the erosion of the island. But it's not just the sea level rise that they're experiencing. They're also seeing impacts in the marine environment, so coral bleaching, which is affecting fish species, and also crayfish, which is an important economic industry in the Torres Strait. They're also seeing effects of loss of seagrass, which affects turtles and dugong, and both turtle and dugong are very important ceremonial, spiritual, and cultural foods and symbols for Torres Strait Islanders. But another thing that we heard again and again was that the seasonal patterns are also changing, and that that's impacting traditional ecological knowledge.
I mean, it seems the plaintiffs have a lot of things to point to show how their lives have changed. But what grounds are you filing this complaint on? Like, does Australia have legal obligations it's neglected when it comes to tackling climate change?
Yeah, it does. So Australia has signed up to this international human rights treaty. So it has promised to guarantee these rights. We are saying that Australia should be judged in relation to these obligations by reference to the Paris Agreement on Climate Change and international law on climate change. And that means that not just Australia, but all states should remain parties to the Paris Agreement, and they should be seeking to reduce emissions so as to meet the 1.5 degree temperature target of the Paris Agreement, because that is really what's required to avoid dispossession of Torres Strait Islanders, but also peoples from other low-lying islands around the world.
What jurisdiction does the UN have, and what sanctions could it impose if it rules against Australia?
The Human Rights Committee can't actually force Australia to comply with its rulings. Unfortunately, it doesn't have the power to enforce its views and recommendations. However, a decision from the committee would still make new international law and, we hope, be influential on both Australia and other countries.
That's Sophie Marjanak with the nonprofit Client Earth. She's also the lead lawyer in a case alleging Australia has not done enough to tackle climate change. Sophie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A little lesson now in an indigenous language called Mi'kmaq, spoken, linguists say, by not more than 10,000 people in the whole world, almost all of them in eastern Canada and a few in Maine. The Mi'kmaq word of the day is Bulisk'iech. It's the first word in this song, so you'll probably guess what it means. Bulisk'iech means blackbird. That is 16-year-old Emma Stevens in Escassoni, Nova Scotia, singing a version of the Beatles' Blackbird, translated into Mi'kmaq.
I know it's just like a little song, and it's just a little cover, but in our language, it's really beautiful, and it just makes a big impact.
Emma's school in Nova Scotia decided to record it as part of events celebrating the UN's Declaration of 2019 as the International Year of Indigenous Languages. Paul McCartney's lyrics help to explain why they chose this song. Blackbird, take these wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arrive. The CBC's program, As It Happens, asked Emma Stevens what those lyrics mean to her.
They speak to me in a way I feel like it should help with, like, how our language is slowly like disappearing. It's kind of going away, and those lyrics kind of make me feel more hopeful, more inspired to like learn my language more than I already know, and to show like non-Mi'kmaq people the beauty of the song and our language in Mi'kmaq.
The translation of Blackbird was written by Kalani Julian, a Mi'kmaq instructor in Eskasoni. She told the CBC that lines like, "Take these sunken eyes and learn to see," were not easy to translate.
We don't have that concept. It just sounds really odd. The concept of sunken eyes would be you do not see properly. Your vision is impaired. So I just took that concept and I explained it to my dad, who was helping me. It was a little hard. I had to be back and forth with my dad about certain topics.
And speaking of songs and their meaning, there's more to this one than meets the eye, as Kalani Julian explains.
From what I understand, Paul McCartney wrote this about the civil rights movement in the United States. So in some sense, you know, we have something in common with the civil rights movement, because to some extent our people have been oppressed in this country, you know, by the Indian Act and, you know, by the federal government. So it really strikes a chord in my heart as well, this song.
This is Where We Fly Away today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Don't was the day born it by it do. Put a whiskey and swab in a hint.
PRI, Public Radio International.